Good morning, members. Welcome to committee this morning. I'd like to call the Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. First order of business is approval of the minutes. We have before us the minutes from February 15th. Representative Neuberger, would you move the minutes, please?
Mr. Chair, after extreme contemplation and study, I move the minutes.
Thank you. Yes, I'm not sure. Any additions or corrections, discussion on the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor of the minutes say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes are approved. How is that? Okay. Yep, we're going to finish up with DNR's budget this morning, members. If you've got your materials in your packet, obviously they're in front of you. And again, we have Ms. Ulick and Director Richards before us. So would you guys identify yourselves for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Barb Ulick, CFO from the Department of Natural Resources.
Mr. Chair, members, Jess Richards, Director of the Lands and Minerals Division for the Department of Natural Resources.
We good, members? Let's proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the opportunity to speak today. I was thinking yesterday when there was 2 minutes to go that I could get up there and I could say, Rocks Real Estate, one initiative, and we're done. And I was hoping for that, but then Forrest took it all the way to the end. So, no
stuff. We were going to do that last night.
yeah, but Amy couldn't film. I know, I understand, yeah. Mr. Chair, members, if you look at your screen here, this is a picture of the Sudan Iron Formation near the Lake Vermilion Sudan Mine Underground State Park. It's the home of Minnesota's first iron ore mining over 130 years ago. So it's just kind of a nice shot of an outcrop that still exists up there for iron ore mining. It wouldn't be a proper lands and minerals presentation if I didn't hand out some rocks to take a look at. For those of you that are on the mining and outdoor recreation subcommittee, you got to see a little bit last week, but I've got some different ones here just to hand around for you to take a look at. The first one we have here is just some iron ore, traditional iron ore from the state of Minnesota, along with a magnet. And you can take that magnet, and you can put it on there, and you can follow the iron ore. The second one is a piece of drill core from the Duluth Complex. It's the largest known resource of copper nickel in Minnesota. So drill core, this was drilled to evaluate the Duluth Complex. If you look at it closely, you can kind of see some of the shimmering areas where there's copper and nickel in this piece of drill core. And then the last piece is something that's fairly unknown to most Minnesotans, and that's that we have Dimension Stone, and this is an example of one that's called Mesabi Black. It's mined in northeastern Minnesota. It is a prominent granite that's used for countertops and things like that, but it's very prominently used in the reconstruction of the World Trade Center in New York City. Mm-hmm. So those are just some examples. There's a lot more. Some of you saw a presentation last year, a lot more different mineral resources in Minnesota all over the state. Those are just a few examples to start things off. So the Lands and Minerals Division manages 12 million acres of the state's mineral rights, and we do this through mineral leasing. You may have seen last week that we just published our next mineral lease sale for 195,000 acres. We manage the Drill Core Library in Hibbing. This is a facility that houses the state's portion of that drill core that I'm sending around right there. We have 3 million feet of drill core there. It's valued, the production value, the value to create that drill core is somewhere around $300 million. We also manage mineral exploration and monitoring the development and the royalty collection from the mines. So in our management of mineral estate, that's our key work there. We also provide real estate services for 5.6 million acres of state land, and so we cover all the things a realtor would do. We handle everything from utility crossings to, you know, leasing of hunting shacks, to land acquisition, to land sales. And then our other part of our division is regulatory, and we regulate the mining industry through permitting programs like the permit to mine, our wetlands permitting, and our water appropriation permitting for mining. In addition to that function of regulatory, we also have a research facility in Hibbing. So our Hibbing office houses about half of our division staff. And one of the key pieces that goes on there is research related to mining-related research, related to environmental issues. And what it does is it helps us get good data to make sound decisions and facilitate sound decision-making in our permitting and environmental review. So I only have four slides. I'm halfway done. All right. If you take a look here, this is just the traditional slide you've seen with many of the other presentations. Under the maintain bar, you can see that this is the dollars that would be associated with the department's overall proposed adjustments that Barb talked about earlier. And then the next bar is our, we have one modest initiative for conservation easement stewardship for $250,000 over the biennium. If you look at the last slide, the DNR holds over 1,100 conservation easements, and they total 384,000 acres. And there's, you know, there's a basic level of stewardship that has to be done and monitoring on these. And in the history of this, it's been covered through LCCMR funding, or in the more recent times through shifts within the department's funding from each division. So what this proposal does is it seeks $250,000 for the biennium to maintain the current staffing that we have for coordinating stewardship activities for our conservation easements. We have one FTE that's currently assigned to it, and then it adds an additional quarter of an FTE to take care of some very specific sites that need some survey work, some amendments to the easements, and then some just other real estate professional services to kind of clean up those sites. So that's the initiative. You know, it's important that a lot of public funds are spent and invested in these easements, and they have a purpose for conservation, and it's important that we continue to monitor them and continue to make sure we finish the baseline work, and this is a basic level of work that be needed, and that's what this initiative is about. So, Mr. Chair, that's all I have, and with that, I'll take any question.
I'm sure there are some. I'm not. I have a couple. Thank you. Mr. Director Richards, you said in your testimony that there's lots more mineral resources in the state of Minnesota. Can you give us some sort of a value of in today's market? I mean, obviously you've done some estimates about how much is out there, and whether it's copper, it's nickel, it's iron ore, whatever, precious metals. How much is out there?
Mr. Chair, members, the state's mineral potential exists across the entire state. So there's, when I was speaking earlier, I was referring that there's multiple different types of minerals. So we have metallic minerals such as iron ore, or our copper and nickel, and we have pretty vast mineral potential across the state, especially in northern Minnesota for that. There's a lot of portions of the state that are yet to be explored, or they have not identified it. They just know there's potential there. The areas that have been identified, we've had some estimates that some deposits, just three deposits in northern Minnesota alone for copper nickel, would represent somewhere in the range of $2 billion in potential royalty revenue for the school trust. That's about the best estimate I have. I don't have the full value estimate. But beyond metallic minerals, there's other minerals in the state, other dimension stones that are valuable. We have sands. We have a whole bunch of aggregate. Every county has aggregate, and that's one of our most valuable mineral resources in the state. I mean, it's needed for our infrastructure development. And so we really do have vast mineral resources across the entire state.
And Mr. Richards, with regards to aggregate, how are we doing on the aggregate mapping? When I served on LCCMR, I know there's been some things. Where are we at in that process?
Mr. Chair, members, we've mapped approximately, I believe, 20 or so of the counties. We got a long way to go, and it is something that is, you know, we believe needs to continue. Right now, we don't have an initiative for that, but we are working closely with the Aggregate Ready Mix Association to see if there's a way to, in the future, get that program going. We are still making progress. We have two counties in process right now that we're mapping, but it's a valuable tool to ensure that the local governments and the state make good land use decisions, you know, to make sure that those aggregate resources are available. Aggregate resources are a local need, and they only supply an area of about 40 miles around the need. So every county needs them, and we got to make sure we find those.
And Mr. Richards, you talked to the drill corps going around. Can you give me some insight on how you go about choosing different spots to take these cores, and how you go about permitting them, and then where are you currently doing some drilling exploration?
Mr. Chair, members, so the way this works with exploration is that we manage the mineral estate through mineral leasing. And so, for example, I mentioned that we just put out an area for consideration that's 195,000 acres. Those acres that are being considered include St. Louis County, Lake of the Woods County, Kuchiching, Beltrami, Itasca. And what happens is that exploration companies come in and they would bid on the ability to get those leases. And then they, if they obtain those leases, then they will go out and they'll do some targeting of where they'd like to drill. It's not an automatic that they would do drilling. In fact, a deep drill hole costs somewhere around $100,000. And so they need to get really specific on where they would like to go. So oftentimes, the vast majority of mineral leases, what they do is they go out and they do some flyovers, and they try to understand the geomagnetic footprint. Then they also would go out and do some more specific on-the-ground kind of walk-around surveys, geophysical surveys. They have fancy equipment, you know, that looks at the rocks somehow. and then they target in, and they might try a drill hole. And what we found is that less than 2% of the sites that we lease have more than one drill hole, because sometimes they'll drill a hole and they see nothing and they leave and they go somewhere else. And so it truly is exploration. Wow. It truly is sometimes a shot in the dark. We know where the main deposits are and the main contact areas are, but that doesn't help you zero in on an area until you got to get out there and explore in order to find them.
And Mr. Richards, you talked about the land sales and so forth that you do and how you manage that. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion around here about land sales, and everybody knows my position on that. One of the things that's frustrated me is the closing costs get mentioned frequently and so forth. I'm curious to know if you have any data or information that would shed light on how the agency's closing costs, because you said you're like a real estate agency or whatever, how do those costs compare to the private market?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't have that off the top of my head, but I'd be happy to go back and take a look at that and see what we can find.
Thank you. And then I just have one more real quick thing. You also talked then about leases for hunting shacks. There's still some left in my area, and there is some frustration with regards to those because the lease rates are going up. It's not something that the legislature sets. It's something you do internally. But I think the greater source of frustration is the restrictions that are placed upon those, quote, hunting shacks in terms of being able to make some improvements, the windows rocked or whatever. But the bigger issue is that you can't do any construction on those. So if a forest fire comes through, which we've had up there, and the shack gets burned down, that's the end. And I think that that's an unwise policy in the agency, and I'd like to work with you to see if we can't change that. So with that, we'll go to Representative Swierczynski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so far for your presentation. We just talked a little bit about kind of the management, when you're doing some of the management work in coordination with the school trust. And particularly my question kind of narrows down a little bit and boils down to the area up in the BWCA and, the school trust folks kind of, they talked about really that trying to figure out for their landlocked areas that are in the BWCA and finding payment through the federal government, but really not executing the constitutional duty when it comes to how do you handle the, from a mineral rights perspective, do you have a rough estimate just from the mineral value just on those locked lands that are within the BWCA and then the requirement from the federal government before those lands can be potentially turned over and how the constitutional side could be potentially worked out?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, that's a tough question. Certainly there is many school trust lands that are within the Boundary Waters Canoe area, and there is mineral potential within the Boundary Waters Canoe area. The Boundary Waters U.S. Forest Service exchange process that's going on is looking at exchanging, lands. It is not looking directly at those mineral issues. They're looking at exchanging lands outside of the Boundary Waters Canoe area, of course, to supply revenue-generating lands for school trust lands. Short of doing exploration in the Boundary Waters to determine the value of those minerals, it's hard to determine what those mineral values might be. But, Mr. Chair, members, I am not working directly on that project, so I'd be happy to see if there's more information specifically about minerals for you and get that for you.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Richards, for coming in. First off, members, if you want to know anything about mining, get a hold of this guy, or minerals, he'll get the facts to you real quick. First off, you talked about the aggregate mapping, and there's some counties that are virtually out of aggregate that is suitable for road building. So when you do the aggregate mapping, do you take into the account the rock deposits that are being crushed and made into road building materials?
Director Richards.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. The mapping process is mostly about your traditional sand and aggregate. Okay. However, we do have a lot of crushed stone in the state of Minnesota that's also used for aggregate. And so we do assist local governments in trying to identify those resources as well.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one other question. Representative Swedzinski brought up the Boundary Waters Canoe area. The mineral question is interesting, but also in regards to the land exchange, a lot of those school trust lands that are in the Boundary Waters would be considered any other part of the state to be prime waterfront real estate. And so in the exchange, potential exchange that's happening and stuff, is that value, real estate value that would happen anywhere else in the state being considered in the value of the exchange?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, again, I will check with the school trust director and as well with our internal school trust administrator. There's a specific valuation process that's being used for doing the appraised value of these lands, both the federal and the state lands in the exchange. I'm not familiar with the details of it, though.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
When you talked about aggregate, you talked about 40 miles. And would you expand on that?
Director Richards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, you know, generally aggregate is considered a local resource, and so the economics of shipping it is around a 40-mile radius from the source. And so if you're doing a road project in a county that doesn't have a good source of aggregate, then you need to look out to your neighboring counties, and you need to hope that it's an economically viable source that's close enough to ship to take care of that road project. So we haven't, now I understand that there's a lot going on as far as looking at improving the economics of longer shipping so that there might be more availability and more sources available for sites. But right now, aggregate really is it's a local resource. And so we've run into situations working with other counties, for example, where there's been, you know, housing developments that have been put right over the best aggregate resource in the county. And then when that county comes along and they want to do road improvements, they have to pay a premium to their neighboring county in order to get aggregate resources.
Representative Wagenius. Yeah. How am I doing? Grab the Dan.
Mr. Chair and friend.
Yes.
So the issue then for aggregate is its shipping cost. Because it's so heavy, is that, and you can't ship it more than 40 or miles without kind of overpaying just because it's so heavy. Am I getting that right?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, I would probably defer to the aggregate industry to answer the exact cost on that. But my understanding is, you know, is that it's the value of the aggregate for sale versus the cost to put it in a truck and ship it for a certain distance, and at some point that's a diminishing return. There's more. I'm simplifying, though, Mr. Chair.
I think it would be interesting for us to better understand that, because when we're mapping aggregate, it needs to be, we've got to have the 40 miles in our head.
And Representative Wagenius, I think that's a little bit of what Representative Eklund was getting at as well, if I heard him correctly, trying to figure out, you know, where our aggregate supplies are and where we have not done the mapping and which areas of the states maybe we should take a look at fast-tracking that mapping so that we can make sure that we do have that 40 miles or whatever it is. So is that where you're going?
Well, I have heard of folks who are thinking, oh, we could use it as an industry to ship outside the state. And I was thinking, I don't think so. I think it's a local, and that's what I'm getting here, it's a very local issue for local construction. It's not an exportable commodity.
And you did mention, too, that some of the best, or Director Richards, maybe some of the best aggregate is now housing developments and so forth, but I know what they did in Hibbing. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. People in Woodbury, I'm just kidding. So, are you finished, Representative Wagenius? Thank Representative you. Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is the example of the drill hole that you're making. And you said that to do this is about $100,000 per drill? And how far down does that go to produce this?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, that's an estimate of a deep drill hole. So in some places you see drill holes that are, you know, only a few hundred feet if the bedrock or the potential resource is close below the surface, and that wouldn't cost that kind of money. But when we talk to explorers, the estimates that we get for drill holes that are beyond 1,000 feet, you know, you're getting into 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. We've had some as deep as 5,000. Now you're talking about $100,000 or more to drill one hole.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, well, I have two questions. Which part is the nickel? Is that the lighter?
So if you, Mr. Chair members, if you look on that piece of core, there's a little white dot that one of my staff put some whiteout on there. And right next to there, you can see some of the copper and nickel that's in there. And in fact, if you had access to that magnet, you can put the magnet on there again, and you can actually feel it kind of come out of there.
Mr. Chairman, so I can see the copperish color. I was just wondering which part was the nickel, and maybe we can talk about that later. So one final question. So when these holes are dug 1,000 feet or whatever, are they closed, or what happens to the holes after they've been dug? And do you have a whole lot of them? I mean, are there many of them in an area? I'm just wondering about access to those very deep areas, especially if there's water tables that have gone through. I mean, what happens with them?
Director Richards.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, the drill hole process is heavily regulated, and so what happens is that if a company, like, for example, might want to drill four holes, they'll go to one location and then drill out four holes from that location rather than going to four different locations. So they'll drill out diagonally or horizontally. And then those holes, they're kept open for a period of time while they study them. So they might do different tests. They actually look at the actual drill core as they bring it up. Then they might run equipment down the holes and do some tests. Sometimes they're converted into groundwater monitoring wells or holes. They use them for studying hydrology and those kind of things. But if not, then they're closed. And so they're capped, they're filled with concrete, they're sealed, and that's all regulated through not only through the DNR, but then also through the Minnesota Department of Health.
Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark's questions triggered a question I should have asked earlier. So every year when the DNR does the mineral lease sales and they announce where they're at, I get emails about turning my district into Swiss cheese. How many, on average, on the leases that are sold, how many are actually explored, and or I guess what's the percentage of something actually happening there? And thank you for letting the members know about capping or closing the drill hole afterwards.
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, when we talk about exploration, there's different ranges of it. So exploration could be simply that they look at a map and say, okay, we have this all under lease, we're not going to look at that section anymore. Exploration could be the flyovers I talked about. Exploration could be walking around, taking a shovel and taking surface samples, things like that. But when you get to the actual drilling, and what people traditionally think of as, you know, mineral exploration, which is the drilling of those cores to dig into the bedrock, of all the leases we do, less than 2% have one drill hole, and less than 1% have two drill holes. And so the vast majority of them, over 80% of our leases, terminate within 5 years. The company that leased them goes out, they do some exploration, they may drill a hole or not, they may fly over or not, and they decide they no longer are interested in that lease, and they let it go, and it comes back to the state, and we think about leasing it some other day. And so, plus at the five-year mark, we ratchet up our rental rates.
Representative, and Director Richards, maybe you said this earlier too. What's the value of kind of the average lease, if such a thing?
Mr. Chair, members, I'll get back to you on that. I know I have it right here, but I don't, unless you want me to dig through my papers right now, but I can get that for you.
Just drill through them whenever you have time. Representative Wagenius.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and friend. As you're looking at minerals underground and trying to understand where the minerals are, how are you progressing on understanding how water moves underground? Basically, how are you doing on a geologic atlases in these areas?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, the Lands and Minerals Division doesn't do the atlases. However, we do work very closely with the Minnesota Geological Survey, who is doing a lot of work on that front. We are part of the Lands and Minerals runs the Minerals Coordinating Committee for the state of Minnesota, and Harvey Thorleson from the Minnesota Geological Survey is a key member of that. He's very active in doing mapping and atlas mapping and groundwater mapping in northern Minnesota, and so we work closely with him. We provide data, we provide access to sites, those types of things.
So some of our counties have atlases and they're up to date. So my basic question is, are the counties involved, are the atlases finished? When will they be finished?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, I do not know when they'll be finished. We could ask the Minnesota Geological Survey what their schedule is, though.
I mean, I know it's a hard...
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a harder area to map than some, but since we're thinking about doing minerals there, understanding how the water flows underground is probably more important than some of the other areas where it's not flowing underground. So it would be, it does seem that we should have a date by when this will be finished. If it's not, if there isn't a date, there should be a date when the job is done.
Director Richards.
Yes, Mr. Okay. Chair, we'll check and see what the plan is and when that work will be done.
Thank you. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, my question is about when you're assessing permit applications, even for exploration, are treaty rights and obligations taken into consideration? And essentially I'm thinking if, even for exploration purposes, if it's not really cost-effective to look at a potential project if ultimately it's not going to be legally feasible. So I'm just wondering if that's part of the decision-making process.
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, so as we look at mineral leasing, we have a number, and I could supply all this for you, we have a number of different screening criteria that we look at. Treaties are not part of the initial screening criteria. Certainly, if there's tribal-owned lands, then that would be part of the things that we look at. The screening criteria, what they do is they look at areas such as the boundary waters or, say, old-growth forests or things like that where we aren't going to do leasing. And then beyond that, we have special conditions. And those special conditions are other natural resource protection categories that are important that we identify then in the leasing process such that if an explorer does choose to lease those lands, they are aware of some very specific natural resources that are out there. With respect to exploration plans then, we do provide notice to the public when we receive those, and we take any input that folks may have on those plans. We have responsibility to review those plans within 20 days of receipt. And unless we make modifications, they're automatically approved. And so what we do is we get that out. We take any input folks may have. Oftentimes what we get is the kind of input that just says it's usually a landowner, you know, who's concerned about somebody coming in onto the land without permission. And that's one of the things that we deal with and we work with all the time. We do meet with the tribal governments on a regular basis. In the Lands and Minerals Division has at least quarterly meetings with the tribal governments where we talk about mineral leasing, exploration, permitting, and the whole, whatever they'd like to talk about.
So,
I guess I would encourage you to maybe relook at that, treaties as the level of obligation we're talking to between our country and the treaties that exist. Should maybe be part of that process. And I I appreciate that you're holding the meetings and that you're looking at tribally owned land, but are the treaties in Minnesota apply to more than just the tribally owned land? And as the, you know, an agreement between the United States and our native nations, that would just encourage you to maybe reassess whether that should be part of that consideration.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Richards. You mentioned about there's minerals everywhere, and I was having to deal with an estate and digging through some old papers and found photos of iron mines in Fillmore County and photos from the 40s, which was kind of interesting. And my mother always told me when we would drive past this area, there were these large divots in the ground, and she said, well, that was from the iron mining. And we thought she was joking. But so you have, when there are drill cores around the state, and you have like the deep drill core, this was a superficial deposit, apparently, that I assume is all played out now. But where else is iron? I mean, I'm assuming we have these cores that have been looked at for years. Maybe the samples were taken 100 years ago. But beyond just the traditional area, because of our geology, what are some things that we may not talk about because we just don't think about them?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, I didn't know about Fillmore County. That's interesting. Traditionally, when we talk about where the iron deposits are in Minnesota, where the most mining has occurred and where the exploration has occurred, you first start with the Vermilion Range up near Lake Vermilion. That's the home of the Sudan Mine and where the first iron ore mining was in Minnesota. Obviously, the Mesabi Range from Grand Rapids to Babbitt, 110 miles, is our most prominent iron formation. And then the Cuyuna Range in the Crow Wing County area was a very prominent mining district up through the prominence was through the 40s and 50s, feeding the World Wars. And that's a manganese deposit, an iron deposit. Still valuable resource there as well. There's actually an iron range up near Gunflint in that area. But I'm not aware of any additional ones beyond that right now.
Thank you. All right. That concludes their testimony for today. Members, we're going to get to Director Martinson, and we've got a short presentation there, and then we want to get to Bowser, and we'll hold questions until the end of this. Director Martinson, identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Lori Martinson. I'm the Director of Operations Services for the Department of Natural Resources. And I do have a very short presentation. I'm just going to talk about my initiative, and then we'll move through to one technical change and move on. So I want to talk to you about an initiative relating to modernizing the DNR webpage. The DNR webpage is really highly valued and highly used web page in state government. We had 9 million unique visitors in 2016. Of those visitors, 3.4 million were on mobile devices. And those folks downloaded 9 million PDF files off of our web page. They trust the information. They want to use it. They want to use it with whatever device they have. I was watching all of you, and you're all very busy doing things on your mobile devices, except you, Mr. Chair. And so what we're asking for is an investment, a continued investment in this initiative. We provided one-time funding in 2015 for us to do some design work, and we're asking for a continued support for us to be able to do this for the citizens of Minnesota. What we are looking to do is to, first of all, modernize the web platform. What does that mean? It means a modern web platform is responsive. So, like, when you look on the DNR webpage now with your mobile device, it looks just like you're sitting at home on your home computer. A modern web platform allows you to open up with your smartphone or other device, and it right-sizes so that you can actually see what you're looking at. You don't have to do with the scroll out and scroll down stuff. So it's responsive is what it's called. It will also improve navigation. I think if most of you have done some looking on the DNR webpage, you use the Google search and you try and find what you're looking for, and you kind of keep trying to look until you find what you're looking for. We'd be able to improve the navigation. We're also looking to improve how we manage the content. I said people downloaded 9 million PDF files. We have really rich content about hunting, fishing, mining, parks and fishing and wildlife. So it's just really rich. And then finally what we're looking to do is to build a digital library. So taking all those PDF files, all of the reports, all of the plans, all of that stuff, and really creating a library so that you can find what you're looking for. Right now, if you look at fisheries research reports, there's like 834 of them, and you just scroll through them so you find what you want. A library would organize it just like when you go to a regular library. I think it would make it easier for the public to be able to access that information. And so that's what we're asking for, a continued investment in this initiative.
Wow. Dr. Hugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Martinson, you were asking for a little over $2 million for this website improvement and things. Do you go out for bid for that price?
Director Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ulan, we'll be using a minute services to be able to help us do that migration to the new web platform, and so we will not be going out for bids to do that.
Representative Ulan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Director, how do you know that Minute is, I'm assuming Minute is charging you, how do you know Minute is giving you a competitive price if it's not out for bid?
Director Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ulan, Minute Central is our IT provider, and so that's who we will be working with. Based on our experience, we get very good services from our Minute DNR folks, and they've done a great job getting us to the point where we're ready to move to the new system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So they're a captive. They're charging you back, but you have really no idea if you're getting charged the correct price or if the private sector could do the job better and cheaper. Is that correct?
Director Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ulan, our Minute DNR staff know our environment. They've built most of the applications that are hosted on our website. They've helped us to build the current website that we have. I think their familiarity is what gives them that competitive advantage.
Representative Ulan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Director, just a little heads up. I'm on State Gov Finance, and there are some agencies that 20% of their budget is taken up by minute costs now. And I think it's very prudent to ask the questions about the value that you're getting. They're good people, I realize that, and everything else, but it seems like some of these costs are out of control. Thank you.
Director Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ulan, I appreciate that. And I want to let you know that for our parks reservation system and our hunting and fishing systems, which host the actual delivery of parks reservations or licenses, we use outside vendors for those because the volume is huge, and we found that they can help us. So we do occasionally go outside and try and find outside help.
Thank you. Proceed. Are you, yep.
We have one technical change
here. Yep.
Mr. Chair, the last proposal is a technical change. There are three general areas these technical changes fall into. The first, and again, these would be budget neutral technical fiscal changes that would require some statute change. The first, we are requesting just to adjust the date of the gas tax transfer to help cash flow needs. Statute says this transfer occurs on June 1st. We run into cash flow issues with some of our accounts, and we're just going to request that the transfer occur April 1st. So a budget neutral debt for the whole process. The second area, we'd be requesting some clarifying languages within how the boat and safety grant program within our law, within our enforcement division works, just to allow that expenditures that occur within the grant period are reimbursed, even if the contract signature didn't quite follow along within the timely process. And the final area are three areas within the Parks and Trails system, just clarifying where to deposit revenues. And the first is just revenues from tours and outreach programs, clarifying where those goes, where those revenues are deposited. Technical cleanup language, when we talk about your camping registration fees, it literally talks about tents. We want to make sure we can include like other camping, like yurts and camper cabins in that definition. And then a clarification on where revenue from special permits on state trails and waterways would go. So very technical. These are all current revenues. It's just where they go. I do have one more slide, Mr. Chair. It's not in your packet. the commissioner wasn't able to come.
I was wondering when that was going to show up.
He did want to send his regards. I believe this is on Lake of the Woods from about a month ago.
Yep.
And he also wanted to make sure that I said that the two gentlemen holding the fish did not catch the fish. They're just modeling the fish.
And I am wearing my DNR pin today.
Yes.
Thank you. That was a great time. I enjoyed it. Representative Green, and then Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a question back on the slide on page 60. You've got five FTEs for the web modifications, but you're using Minute. Are these new FTEs? Are these moved around? Is this from Minute, or what is this for?
Director Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, these are new positions in DNR. Three of the FTEs are for managing content within the divisions, so actually paying more attention to the content that we have that's on the web. One is for a coordinator position to oversee the web to make sure the content is fresh and current and being managed, and then the other is for the digital library.
Representative Green.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And then you don't have to do this now, but I would like to talk to you as far as you're looking for modifications, and I'm wondering why you want to pay. Looks like you want to pay the contract before the contract's complete. Is that what you're doing on your second bullet point?
Oh, no, Mr. Chair, Representative Green. No, it's when we have a grant period for law enforcement contracts under the boat and water safety. So these go to local sheriffs. And if the grant period, say, is July through June, and we've encumbered the money, but we literally didn't get all the signatures in place till July 15th, it just says any of the expenditures from July 1st to July 15th are eligible to be reimbursed.
Okay, thank you. Members, I know that the core samples that are here and stuff are valuable, but please turn them back in, okay? If you have one, hold it up. The pages will get it. Representative Eklund, and then Backer, and then we're moving to Bowser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question I asked the other day, and it might be more appropriate here. Director Martinson, you talked about outside vendors for some certification things like border safety that children have to take and stuff like that when they do it online. First off, does the DNR get a percentage from the vendor? That because if my child goes on there and has to pay his $20 or $25 or whatever.
Mr. Chair, I think this is a question for Colonel Smith in the Enforcement Division, and we'll make sure to
look at that. Okay.
And then just to follow up.
Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you open source those vendors, or are they captive vendors for who offers those services?
Mr. Chair, we'll get back to you, but I believe they go up for RFP, but I'll just make sure.
Thank you.
Representative Backer.
Chair. Yes, Director Martinson. Could I get a breakdown of the $2.1 million? We just went through our website, and we have some of the same amount of visitors that I have that you guys do, and we just went mobile, go live next week, and our budget was even close to that. So I would like to understand that. Instead of just criticizing you right away, I would like to understand that and see if we can help, because that's my business is Internet, so I would appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Julek and Director Martinson. And Director Jasky and Assistant Director Becker Kadelka. And members, we're going to let them get through their entire presentation, and we will hold questions until the very end.
one of the things you heard about.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members.
Welcome.
John Jasky, Executive Director, Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Proceed with your testimony.
Okay.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll get going. First off, our mission is to work on private lands, and we do that through local governments and other partners at the local level on all of our programs. Our agency, our business model, if you want to describe it that way, is again focused on private lands. We have a small cadre of staff, about 100 or 105 or so. We do have a small staff because the bulk of our work is delivered through local governments, through soil and water conservation districts, counties, watershed districts, cities, even from townships, and also several different collaborations of those organizations through joint powers agreements. We're governed by a board of directors that it consists of local governments, agency commissioners, citizens, and those members are appointed by the governor. And we focus on private lands. This is a map of Minnesota where we indicate where the private lands are. Of course, most of you know all about this already, having heard testimony from DNR and other agencies. And it's important that we use that local conservation delivery system because when you're working with private landowners, they need someone that they can turn to who is trusted and local and can work with them to either solve a problem or take advantage of an opportunity that is going to be in the public benefit but require their private property to do that public benefit. Getting into the budget, this is the overall chart here showing where the funding that we currently operate with comes from. One thing that you'll see here is, of course, we'll talk more about these in more detail. The federal funding is a very small slice, but one of the things that we do is work with the federal agencies to bring federal dollars to Minnesota for conservation clean water purposes. That is not reflected in this chart because those dollars typically go directly to individual landowners. This shows the budget by program area, which is the way the presentation was organized in your book. By and large, the area, and I guess that's peach or pink, something like that, is about practices on the ground, and as well as the part that's light blue, those are both building something or constructing something or accomplishing a practice or a project. The purple area is for some of the requirements for protection through regulatory purposes and means. And then we have our 8%, which is agency administration and operations. Overall, if you take all the sources together, about 90% of our funding goes out to local governments for their work with private landowners. And we can describe some more of those details in a bit. And the remaining 10% is for the agency expenses. So we'll break this down into a couple different pieces and focusing on the change items to make sure we have enough time at the end for any questions. Again, this category of funding here is a combination of funding to local governments. You can see the block grants, of course, go directly to county governments. We also have the Wetland Conservation Act, some of which is internal and some of which is external. And drainage assistance, we'll talk more about drainage systems as part of our water infrastructure. Again, that's both internal and external. There are two change items we'll focus on, and I'll get to those here in just a minute. This is the list of those statutory provisions that we carry forward, the Wetland Conservation Act. Again, all of these have parts of statute that direct how they're operated. The drainage law, which manages the movement of water off the land for purposes of egg production and other development, the buffer law, which you've heard about already, and, of course, excessive soil loss is also part of the statutory requirements. So I'll focus on the change items. One of them is actually on its way. The local road wetland replacement program is a statutory provision in Minnesota Chapter 103G that directs the agency to mitigate the wetlands that are affected by local government, county, city, township road projects. This has been working very well for the last 20-some years. It gives the local road authorities a streamlined permitting approval process both at the state and the federal level, and it gives a better environmental outcome as well, because we get, you know, higher quality wetland offsets in places where they're going to be welcome and ecologically productive. The challenge, of course, is that the funding has been short, and it's you know, from prior years, the bonding appropriations, which have been used pretty much exclusively for this, have been short of what is the need. And the need is based on the amount of road construction that affects a wetland, basically. So this is a record in the last several years about what we've needed and what we've been appropriated. And so what that's led to is a deficit or a shortage of wetland credits to offset those impacts in several parts of the state. And so last fall, the agency had to put in place a process to close the availability of this program for the local road authorities. And so that situation hadn't happened before, but we were faced with no other option. The governor's recommendation, and actually, you know, for this body, this is pretty well on its way. House File 434, Mr. Chairman, that you authored, is now passed and onto the floor, I believe. So it will solve this problem in a temporary fashion for the local road authorities, so they can get their projects going again, or going and or bidded this spring, and get their road projects, you know, back on schedule. So if that bill passes, then all of that will be undone, and we will be back where we were temporarily, and then we'll have to make sure that down the road the bonding funds, which the governor has also recommended at $10 million, would be able to prevent this problem from happening again. So hopefully that one is on its way. The other item in our initiative that relates to wetlands is some funding to deal with some outdated technology that, you know, we're still using, you know, paper forms for most of the wetland applications that local governments process and are routed around for review and comment, and we were thinking that there's better ways to do that in this day and age. We also have in this proposal a component that will allow us to continue the pursuit or exploration, maybe the better word, of the 404 assumption, which is something this committee talked about in commission last year, and we've completed this assessment. But if you know, continue the work to get the federal government to help us understand what it's going to take to accomplish this regulatory efficiency, we've got to do some more work to keep that moving forward. So that number from in the governor's recommendations is $625,000. Some of this is one time. There's a little bit that goes on further. I should mention, too, that the prior item that I mentioned for the local road projects is a one-time recommendation from the governor from the general fund, and then, again, transitioning to bonding as it has been. In this case, this amount is mostly one-time. It's for these three things that we are listing here in the top three bullets, the 404 assumption, program pursuit, the online permitting system, and then we also have this in-lieu fee program, which allows some more flexibility in terms of local authorities allowing landowners to do wetland impacts, and then instead of having to make the wetland themselves, they can do an in-lieu fee option, which currently doesn't exist but is authorized by federal and state law. Moving on to the next area, local land and water conservation, there's just one change item in here. This category of budget includes, you know, the conservation dollars that are delivered to soil and water conservation districts for programs and projects. It also includes two pass-throughs, really, for the Red River Basin Commission, which is an international nonprofit that includes Minnesota, North Dakota, and Manitoba in doing water management in the Red River Basin. It's been very successful in working across those political or geopolitical or even international boundaries, and so that money goes to that organization to do that work. They also get funding from those other members from North Dakota, Manitoba, and from local governments on all sides of those borders as well. And Area 2 flood controls in southwestern Minnesota. Area 2 is, you know, named for a study that was done, you know, quite a number of years ago now, but it is set up to hold and retain water on the land. For both flood control but also some water quality benefits, and they have a joint powers authority among the counties down there that is set up for this very purpose. And that's why earlier on when I mentioned that we work with a number of local governments, but they've also in many instances, and more of them are coming, joined forces either on a watershed scale or in this case on a multi-county scale to do water management. We have one change item in here. It has to do with our conservation easements, and I'll cover that in just a second. There are a few of the categories that are in this bundle of activities. It's our local conservation delivery programs to the soil and water conservation districts primarily. We also have this, you know, approach now, statutory approach to manage water on a watershed basis. This one watershed, one plan is now in policy, and we have some funding allocated for that purpose under the Clean Water Fund, and Angie will talk about that in a little bit. There's a conservation cost share program, which is what the soil and water districts use for doing many of their projects on the private land, whether they're in urban areas or agricultural areas or forested areas. They use that same program to treat the resource concerns or with private landowner participation across the state and have done that for many decades. The one recommendation here is from the governor's budget on the conservation stewardship program, or it's really not a program, it's a function. We have the Reinvest in Minnesota program is well established, and it uses a variety of different mechanisms to achieve conservation, both protection and restoration. We'll talk about that in a minute. But when we have, in the case of our program, over 7,000 easements, of which, you know, most of them don't have a stewardship mechanism, this is a small contribution to get that going, because we do have an obligation to monitor those. And the good news is that we're able to use the Soil and Water Conservation District infrastructure to do that, because they're very local and they work with those landowners and they can check these things very efficiently. But it's gotten down to the point where the amount we can pay them is down to $49 per inspection. And we know that the costs are actually closer to $275 per inspection. And so we can't keep asking them to do this work for a price that they can't afford to do. So we're going to have to try and get this fund built up, and this is a small contribution to that. Again, here our Reinvest in Minnesota program is an easement program, and we have several variations of that to deal with whatever the landscape and resource concerns might be. And, of course, this is a voluntary program. Landowners participate voluntarily through sign-ups, and we do a scoring and ranking for each of these. Wetland restorations are a big chunk of that. We also use this program to acquire easements along some of the wild rice lakes in north central Minnesota, where we're protecting that resource is important, and the mechanism is really just trying to buy a right to limit development in the area that would otherwise be sensitive to farms of the wild rice resource. Riparian buffers is a really important part of this program, always has been, and now, of course, even more so with the policy that was enacted a couple of years ago. ACUB or ACUB is a program that we've been working on for a number of years now around Camp Ripley. Most of you know about where that is in central Minnesota, Morrison County, also a little bit of Crow Wing and Cass County. That military installation is really important for state and national reasons, but it's got a perimeter that is largely private land, and so in order for them to keep that operation functional from noise and other military uses inside the Camp Ripley, they embarked on this effort with us, along with DNR, doing some acquisition to buy easements around the perimeter so that the land would still remain in private ownership, but it would limit incompatible uses. And so hence the name of the program, which is Army Compatible Use Buffer Program. And it's really we allow a different type of use, so the farming can continue, other types of development can continue. It's just trying to prevent residential development right next to the perimeter of this Army or Camp Ripley installation or National Guard base, because otherwise people who happen to, you know, put a new residence there are going to be bothered by the noise next door is really what it comes down to. So is this really not compatible? So, but lots of other uses are, and so, you know, we want to make sure those go forward. So we've got a program that's uniquely set up for that, and we've also been able, because of this program, bring some of the federal defense dollars into Minnesota for this. Wellhead protection is also a pretty important use of this, where municipal wells are protected by acquiring easements over the area that would otherwise potentially be bringing some pollution potential into those municipal wells. And also shoreline areas that are important for habitat reasons are also included. And the funding sources are listed there for these programs. So, and one big one that you've heard about a little already, I'm sure, from us or someone else, is the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, which we worked on for several years, and the governor submitted an application, and the USDA has now approved that just last month. And this will allow us to, again, on a voluntary basis, bring in, you know, a large chunk of federal money in direct payments to landowners who want to participate in this program, and it will include, in this instance, wetland restorations, buffers, and wellhead protection in this geography you see here on the map in southern and western Minnesota. The governor's recommendations for this program include $30 million in bonding, $33.5 million in clean water fund. And these aren't, we grouped this a little bit here so it would make this slide a little easier to read, because there are several categories in the clean water fund and outdoor heritage that contribute to this. But the Outdoor Heritage Fund bill is moving forward with this 15.731 in total. The LCCMR recommendations included $6 million. That gets us, if all of those come to fruition as recommended, we'd get $85 million, and you know, that's pretty close to what we actually need, is about $96 million more to fully commit the state part of this program and leverage those federal dollars. So, Chairman, I'll turn over to Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and members, the next one is our agency and administration operations. There's one change item in this. Administration and agency operations include all the standard things that you've heard about from other state agencies. For us, it's also our board operations, since we're governed by a board. And our training includes not only for our staff, but for the statewide local government staff as well. So bringing them information and training and delivery in how to implement programs, the latest and the changes in those programs, as well as the technical pieces around how do we design, construct, inspect some of the conservation that's happening on the ground. We've already taken several steps to reduce any sort of overhead, to increase efficiency and reduce costs. We are in process of closing one of our regional offices right now. We co-locate with other state agencies around the state when we have our regional offices. We have interagency agreements to support several of our functions. With a staff of 110, we recognize that it makes sense to work with other agencies as needed for things like HR, for design work that goes above and beyond our standard ability for that capacity. We also share resources and positions federally. For example, the technical training that I just mentioned, we are right now in a contract with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, where each agency is contributing 50% towards building that technical training program. And we've also done more with vehicle sharing and carpooling to try to reduce some of those costs. Some issues that we still have in this category: we have an unfunded statutory mandate to do a performance review and assistance, or local government oversight. That's been traditionally funded through cost share returns. So if we were to issue a grant to a local government, let's say for $20,000, and the actual project ended up only being $18,000, $2,000 comes back to the agency. Well, then this has been the source of the funds to provide the oversight program. As technology and targeting has gotten better, so have their estimates of projects, and so that pool has been decreasing steadily. There's fewer cost share returns coming back into the agency. And so this is a mandate that we have to provide that oversight that is not funded. We also have rising technology or minute costs, personnel costs, lease costs that are direct increases to the agency. So this recommendation, the governor's recommendation, supports that. This table off to the right shows the local governments that actually went through a level two, which is a standard performance review per year. It shows some of the local governments that we've served this last year. And it's also the change item is also to cover the minimum required for those increased agency costs. So that's our general fund overview, recognizing that the Clean Water Fund is over half of the agency's proposed budget. And also we know that this is going to be going through Representative Gunther's committee and as it moves through. I thought we'd just briefly share some of those key pieces for the agency through the Clean Water Fund. So there's the buffer and soil loss implementation. As Director Jaski said, the One Watershed, One Plan, driven by local governments to look at, rather than just those geopolitical boundaries of how do we manage water, look at how do we manage water across the watershed scale. We have our competitive grant features and programs that help to accelerate conservation on the ground with drainage, and look at programs that are going through these multi-year plans. How can we assess progress towards goals? We also have the easement programs, which Director Jaski mentioned before. And so a few examples of what this looks like. This first one is the Sandhill River. And this is up in the northwest part of the state. It is in Polk County. And this was in the early 1900s, landowners ditched and drained and diverted water to get water off the land. Made sense. It got water off the land at the time. However, the amount of sediment and erosion and bank stability started to increase. And so in the 50s, the Army Corps put in these great big structures to try to hold back water to let the sediment drop out. And now, 60 years later, the amount of sediment that's going through the Sandhill River watershed is increasing erosion. It's increasing flows as things happen. This grant then was working with the West Polk Soil and Water Conservation District and others to figure out how can we slow down that sediment? What are ways that we can slow down the grade to keep dropping that out so that that erosion isn't going through? Another example, this is in Benton County. This is Mayhew Big Elk Lake. This was a phosphorus reduction program. There's an impaired water here, and I think it's impaired for phosphorus, and then there's also sediment issues. This is for the Benton County Soil and Water Conservation District to work directly with landowners on how can we improve feedlot runoff, how can we look at nutrient management, and how, especially with livestock producers, how can we make a difference with phosphorus reduction. And this is an example of progress towards goals. So the Benton Soil and Water District said, if these Clean Water Fund practices are implemented, this will get us 36% of the way towards our goals for this particular lake and lake shed. And so progress towards goals is an important way for us to understand what are we getting? You know, what does the state get for the dollars and for moving forward? Here's an example up in northeast Minnesota. This is the Poplar River watershed with the Cook Soil and Water Conservation District. This one actually gets 100% of the way there. And so the Poplar River is an area that has a natural trout fishery. It's an area that's a recreation and natural area and economic engine along the North Shore. This one, the stream banks have caused major erosion. There's gully repair that needs to be done. And stabilizing these problem areas is the big concern for the folks up in the Cook SWCD area. So this program is a long-term, it's a four-year grant program that goes through and does the necessary repairs, the necessary protections that will actually get 100% towards the goal. There's also multiple benefits, and so this one shows how we can bundle programs together, each with their own different function, to help out a larger issue. And so this one happens to be in Redwood County. These are the Jensen sisters, who in this case took an easement, and it was combining both for water quality reasons and for habitat. And so the first area was around water quality, and the rest of it, the distance of the easement, is for habitat. To make a difference in pollinators, to make a difference in sediment and phosphorus reduction, and pairing out those together towards reaching other benefits or combining benefits. The context for this is important. Scale matters. And so when we talk about progress towards goals, it isn't easy, as we all know and as you all know, that something in a large watershed or large river basin might only a project or series of projects or a grant might only get something towards 1% towards the goal, for example, in the St. Croix River, whereas a particular lake shed that has something that's smaller that's contained, that same group of projects might get us 62% of the way towards that lake shed. So it's context that matters as we talk about. It isn't that the 1% is worse than the 62%. It's all in the context that we look at outcomes. Leverage is also key to the state dollars that you appropriate for these agency works. This shows dollars that have been leveraged by state investment. And it's also an economic driver. And so based on a report from the Natural Resource Conservation Service, they estimate that for every $100,000 that's spent, for example, in RIM funding, that there's $128,000 of total economic output. And so that's what it averages is one new job that's created or maintained, because it's the local contractors, and then it's the local contractors that go in and eat at the cafe for lunch, and so that total economic output that happens for getting this money out locally for on-the-ground practices. And finally, the Board of Water and Soil Resources is 30 years old this year, so it's created in 1987, and through these partnerships, these are 30 years of accomplishments on the screen, including over 18,000 practices that have been installed. And so with that, Mr. Chair, we stand ready for questions.
Thank you, Directors. Representative Wagenius.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and no friends. Okay. I'm looking back on page 9 at your conservation easements, and I don't know when the last time you updated your easements themselves, I mean, how they're written and what they ask for. So there are two things I'm interested in. One is you are doing easements now for where an easement, it might be inappropriate in an easement. Are you requiring that easement holder to keep water on the land?
Directors. Mr. Chairman and Representatives, it depends on the type of easement that it is. And so if you see this list here again, the ones that specifically do that, of course, are the wetland restorations, because the wetland restorations, you're going into a site where wetland had been drained and we're removing whatever drainage mechanisms are there and putting back the water, holding the water back, and of course putting in the native vegetation and all that as well around that area. The incompatible use buffers, we're simply protecting the land from developments. We're paying a lower price, and that land will not be developed, but it will continue to be operated either as farmland or as natural land. So it is a protection easement. And so it just depends on the design and the site-specific parameters that the easement is purposed for.
Representative, follow-up.
Yes, thank you. A couple of questions, but where it is appropriate, are you specifically, say, you're protecting some land so it won't be developed, which is big. Are you specifically writing into the easement some of the water protections that we are aiming for? I mean, I think when easements were first done years and years ago, they didn't have those things in them. And so I'm just...
Director Yaski.
Are you up to date in Kansas City?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Morganius, I believe we are, because we, as Angie said, we are maximizing the restoration on each site. And so that includes, putting back as much water as we can, where the natural conditions allow it. And, of course, property boundaries have to be respected as well. And we're always using native vegetation, so that allows us to get as much water holding capacity as we can on all those sites, whether it's the wet area or even the upland area. All of that is designed to be back to natural conditions.
One follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative?
Yes. Yeah. On that same slide, you have wellhead protection, and you're using some of this money for wellhead protection. So we know that there are maybe 350,000 vulnerable acres. At the rate you are going with this money you're asking for, when will the state have finished the wellhead protection?
Director,
goal, finishing it up, when it will be done?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, I have to come back with some further analysis on that, but here's what I would say is that, you know, we've acquired about 7,000 easements in 30 years, and we've got somewhere in the neighborhood of half a million acres in that area. Easements aren't the only tool, mind you. We have to look at a lot of other tools, too, you know, how those lands can be both used for production and protective of water quality. I think it's going to be a very, very important way we look at protecting wellheads, because we can't take all that land out of production. Those are some very useful parts of our landscape, too. So I think we can come back with a better answer about which of them are set up for an easement mechanism to be the solution, and look at other options in the rest of those areas, because one tool isn't going to be the only one we need.
Representative Ugo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question relates to, on page 10, your last slide there, administrative and agency operations. You have a change item on that for $1.2 million. That's a big change item. What does that entail?
Directors.
Mr. Chair and representatives, so the $1.2 million is for the direct costs and increases that the agency has incurred for Minute for IT support. So, for example, our desktop support cost increased 21% from fiscal year 16 to fiscal year 17. So that's, you know, covering those direct increases that come into the agency. It's for all of our lease increases for where the agency has our regional offices. It's also for the personnel increase cost. So as, you know, somebody goes through, if there's a cost of living increase that's applied to staff. And then it's also for the fourth one is to fund the performance review and assistance program. That's of that, that's the largest chunk, which is $250,000. And that's to fund that position, so because there's not return cost shares, but it's also a small pool of money that we work directly with local governments as part of their operations to make sure that we can help them function in a way that is efficient and effective.
Representative, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Director, you mentioned some administrative costs and salary costs and so on and so forth. Wouldn't that be under your regular administrative and agency operations costs?
Director Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and members, so this is the change item, so we start with that base, and so this is so we had everything put into one change item that was the increases.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Director, okay, of this $1.2 million, which is a 10% change here, how much of that is Minute cost?
Assistant Director.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I will need to get back to you on that exact number, but I will find that, and we have our piles here, and we'll get you that exact number.
Thank you.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm looking at page 13, slide 26. That's a lot of grant money going to our local governments and conservation districts. Do you know what the breakdown is by region, either by county or by rural, urban, suburban, where those dollars are going?
Directors.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, we have that. We'll get you that information. It is, these dollars are spent across the entire state. I can't say this for sure, but I'm going to expect that it's true that every county in the state has had these dollars applied to them. I know every watershed has, and so I have to go look at the county thing, but absolutely, we can get you the information. And again, they're all competitive, so they, you know, they have to be scored and ranked. And it's also true that when we put out the request for proposals, we get in the best proposals, and we are only able to fund somewhere between 20 and 25% of them. So 75 to 80% of the applicants who say they're ready to do something go home with nothing, because their demand and the need is quite high. So that's been true for the last half dozen years or more. We'll get you some of those details on both demand as well as where the projects have been funded.
Thank you.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and directors. I've got two questions. The first one's on page 7, where you talk about the continued work towards the 404 assumption. Balzer, Association of Minnesota Colonies, many other interest groups have been working on this project for better than a year, if I'm not mistaken. My question is once all this is done and you make a recommendation, is there any indication of whether the Army Corps or the federal government will buy off on this?
Director?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there will be some indications. Those indications can change over time, too, depending on how they're made in court cases and even, you know, with the new administration, maybe there's changes that are going to be coming that we don't even know about. But the point of the whole thing is that the state, under federal law, and two states have done this, New Jersey and Michigan have already done this, where they basically carry out this federal responsibility through state law and responsibilities. The next step, which this recommendation is for, is to do what you just described, which is to go work with the federal agencies, the Corps of Engineers and the EPA, so they can tell us exactly what we do have to do. That is the next step. The communication has been started with those agencies, but there needs to be more definitive provisions from them coming to us so we know what to do, both in our policy, what we have to make some adjustments to, and in how much it might cost the state to carry out this program with that federal delegation.
Representative Eklund, follow-up.
Not on that one, Mr. Chair, but I do have one other question, if I may. On page 15, the Poplar River Watershed Project in Cook County. You said it was 100%, the 100%, or the outcome was 100%, but that's an ongoing project,
Mr. Chair and members, yes, so the project is still in process, and they are anticipating that by the end of the project they will reach that 100%. So.
Representative, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is, Poplar River, I'm very familiar with it, obviously, and it flows through both a ski resort and a golf course. Are you getting good buy-in from those entities on helping with this project?
Directors?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, absolutely. And the Cook Soil and Water Conservation District has been involved with local landowners throughout this entire process, as well as local business owners.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jaskey, you said you had 7,000 easements over the last 30 years, and that takes in about a half a million acres?
That's my recollection. Yes, somewhere in that neighborhood, yes.
On page 9, yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. On page 9, slide 17, you show a map with a whole bunch of red dots on there. Mm-hmm. All those dots add up to half a million?
Director?
Mr. Chair, those dots aren't size-based, but that's where the locations of those easements are. That's correct.
Okay. Representative Green. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I figured. But do you have an easy site on your website where I can go and not only get maps but get where the locations are? Because sometimes navigating the websites are a little bit complicated and you have to go to many pages. Is there something that's simple that can break that down?
Director?
Mr. Green, yes, so on the websites, I agree with you. You know, we in fact are one of those agencies that need to upgrade our website, but it takes time and money to do that too. But we do have something to handle what you're looking for. We have a database that is of all of these easements that is accessible through our website, where any easement can be located on this database and it, to the public in any way, or show where the location of the easement is, the boundaries of it. There's some other information, the private information that goes with it is kept in the same database, but that's not publicly accessible. So we can, through the website, you can see every easement and its location on by just viewing that website database.
Representative Green, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then on your monitoring data, Is there something there too? Do you go year by year? So, you know, you talked about goals, and I kind of laugh because the one goal on the Poplar River is 40 years, and so that's quite a long goal. But do you have a list of goals for all your sites so that you know where you're going to meet? And can you tell us, For instance, you've got 7,000 easements. Do you have a goal of how many you think you need across Minnesota to reach your goal?
Directors.
Mr. Chairman, the goals are, the water quality goals, for example, are contained in the local water management plans that the counties, watershed districts, and soil and water districts prepare and adopt, and the state approves those. So the easements are one tool, as I mentioned before. There's other tools, types of projects that they do. Some of them are very much more limited duration. There's, 10-year contracts. There's simply voluntary actions that are helped along by technical assistance. So we call it the conservation continuum, where, someone just getting some advice could be all that's needed, or you go into the other end of the continuum, which is a long-term set-aside program. And so there's lots of options that landowners are given, both by the state agencies as well as the federal agencies, but they're both delivered through those local agents.
Okay. Representative Green.
Thank you. And then you also said that you coordinate with other agencies. I know you deal in private lands, but do you ever have problems with state lands that are not being managed and getting sediments and problems from that? Because I know, like in our area, maybe not so much in the portions that are water, but you guys deal with those. We have a huge problem with invasive weeds and weed problems that are not taken care of on state lands. But in your area, do you ever have any problems with other state lands?
Director Jaski.
If we have a problem, it gets typically identified at the local level and they deal with it. I couldn't speak to specifically the source of those, but I guess we can go back and check and see if we've had any of those over the last several years. But normally that would have been dealt with very locally at the county or soil and water district or watershed district office.
Okay. And one more and then I'll quit.
Representative.
Ms. Kadelka, on the Papa River, to get to your 100% is going to take 40 years, but you were talking about your goal on the Sand Hill River, which is close to my district, Sand Hill River Watershed, and you're looking at getting to 50% as your goal. How many years is that going to take?
Assistant Director, get up.
Mr. Chair and members, the Sand Hill project, I believe, and Director Jack, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that is part of a 3-year grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to, I believe, slide 18, there was a mention about the monitoring or oversight of those conservation easements, and maybe I misunderstood, but I thought I heard you say you were paying about $49 per monitoring event, but the costs were running about $200.
Directors.
Am I correct in what I heard?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, you did hear it correctly. It's the soil and water conservation districts do that work, and we have a requirement to do those once every 3 years, and the amount of money we have and the number of easements they have to inspect has led us to the point where they get about $49 per easement when the costs are over $200, yes.
I definitely have a follow-up,
Representative.
A couple of them. I guess, first of all, then, assuming that monitoring takes place, who is paying the rest of that?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the Soil and Water Conservation District is having to cover that with funding that they get from other sources.
Representative.
Can we be a little more specific on those other sources?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, it may be from either other state funding that we provide to them, which is not much, but it may also be from the county or others that they get their budgets from.
Representative Lewitt.
We're a lot closer. I'll just make the blanket statement that, yes, local property taxes get hammered on that or that work doesn't get done. Second question, have you took a long-term strategic look at the liability that's out there? $49 versus $200 for the agency and the entire approach here? Because if we're that far off right now, that's not going to continue indefinitely, and we're going to start to hurt the local programs because there's a huge amount of pressure at the local level to stay within budget in a whole bunch of areas. So
I mean, I don't know if you've got a quick answer for that, but it looks to me like you better get the bean counters and start looking strategically whether we're headed for a crash.
Director Jasky.
Mr. Representative, actually a few years ago, the legislator Wagner did an audit of conservation easements, and one of the things that they recommended was to establish a fund for the very purpose you're describing, which is so that when the state makes the investment in these sites, that there's a way to make sure we take care of it. And that took a couple of years, but in 2015, there was a law passed that created this fund that we now are able to put dollars into that then will generate the mechanism to pay for this long term, but this is a contribution to that fund to get it going because it's going to take a while to build it up.
Members, I'm just going to quickly mention we have about four names yet on the list and about 10 minutes. So, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I could use all 10 if you'd like. I'll try to keep it brief. Director Jasky, I have a governance question. You know, you're governed by a 20-member board, yet our budget recommendations are coming through the governor's office. Can you kind of describe, you know, who's in charge when it comes to Bowser?
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, the statutes set it up so that the agency is governed by a 20-member board who serve four-year terms. All the commissioners of the agencies of DNR, PCA, Ag, Health, and University of Minnesota, they sit on the board. So you have the rest are appointed by the governor to four-year terms. That represents counties have three members, so water districts have three members, watershed districts have three members, and then the rest are citizens. And so we have monthly meetings. Everything that we do has to be done through a process that includes, you know, notice and all of it's transparent that way. It includes appropriating the money for the grants that were asked about. It includes adopting any rules or policies that the agency needs to carry out the programs. The board then hires the executive director, and the director hires staff, is the way the statute is all prescribed in Minnesota Statute 103B.101. And we are an executive branch agency, so of course our budgets and everything go through that same process.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, for instance, these change items that are listed that we've gone through today, have they gone through the board process or have they been strictly brought through from administration?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the board is carries out the budget and the policies. The proposals that are for the agency, like all others, come from the executive branch through the governor's process.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jasky, I'm assuming you're aware of the legislative auditor's report that just came out this morning about internal controls. Are you aware that you've been cited?
Director.
Mentioned, maybe, Mr. Chairman, might be the right word. It has to be. I mean, I'll call it a technical fiscal matter. It's simply a matter of what we report and when we report it. And we believe it's totally taken care of. But I can talk with you more about that in another setting if you'd like.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for choosing the wrong word. But it'll have to be addressed. And then just one final question. The governor has announced his 25 by 25 proposal. Do you have any comments on Bowser's role in that effort? Mm-hmm.
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, Torkelson, the idea there is that we will be one of the agencies, among others, that will be asked to go out and get input from stakeholders and the public about how to best work to achieve that goal, and that would be the process that would take place over the next, 6+ months, and then that would be brought back to the legislature for consideration next year.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, this may be a very basic question, but when the phosphorus is reduced, like from the feedlot that you showed on page 15, and when the sediment is held back by the structure that you showed on page 14, what happens with that over a period of time? Does it just sit there? At some point, the structure is going to be overcome. What happens with those concentrated
directors.
Sediments and nutrients?
Mr. Chair and members, it depends on the practices that have happened. So if the practices are happening on the ground, phosphorus, for example, is tied to soil, and so it will keep it on the ground on the farm field where it can be most productive and most used. And of course, if as with ditch maintenance or things, if there's soil that gets into the ditch, then of course those things are cleaned out over time as well. So it all depends on, I think, the practices that are going in and kind of what that intended outcome is.
Mr. Chairman, just one
quick follow-up.
Just one quick question. The structure that's showed on slide 29, page 15, looks like it's actually holding. It doesn't look like it's on the field anymore. It looks like it's in a trough. Is that what I'm seeing there, or is my wrong?
Oh.
Now, Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a feedlot. You can't see the whole picture there. In fact, the lake is over the hill. But that all of that, in this case, it was manure, basically, that gets collected instead of being allowed to leave the property. In fact, it's a zero discharge facility. There's no pollution that can leave that facility once it's designed and put into this practice. And so they have means to store it, move it off the land, integrate it into the land, and put it back in as a nutrient for the cropland or the hay ground, wherever they're going to put it.
Representative Johnson Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question relates to the wetland replacement program. Are you aware of what the current demand is for this construction season for the wetland credits?
Directors.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there is a list that we get that is, on average, we end up with about 200 acres a year of credits that we need per year. If this legislation passes that has gone through the committee already, we would instantly open up all those bank service areas so road projects could continue, but that would be until we got more money to keep it going. So it would solve the problem in the short term. If additional funding is provided via bonding or some other source, I suppose, we will continue to move forward with that 200 credits a year that we're going to have to create.
Representative, a follow-up.
And then two related questions to that. First of all, do you know how much of that $5 million will be used immediately in this construction season, and also how many jobs we're talking about?
Directors.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't have the numbers on jobs, but we can get back to you on estimates of that. I'll have to ask staff to give me the list that we currently have, because the reports keep coming in daily or weekly, whatever the schedule is for road authorities, telling us how much they need. So we'll get you that list.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, as a follow-up, members, the other piece of this is the goal with that $5 million is to immediately start looking for credits that the state can purchase to start for the construction season immediately. And so the goal is to look at credits, where we can find them, and start that process so that, as Director Jasky said, we can open up those bank service areas right away.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jasky, we've had conversations, I think it's for 5 years, about our floodwater retention areas and the possibility of designing them so that we actually create wetlands inside of them, and it's a discussion that really has gone nowhere, I would say. I think the potential there for wetland replacement credits is potentially terrific. Do you have anything in your sites, anything in your budget proposal, and if I missed it, I apologize, I had to step out for another meeting, that's going to get us closer to that goal of mine, and I know many people in the legislature, to get to that point?
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just answer the question this way. We don't have anything in the budget proposal, but we are working on that idea. We had a meeting of our staff and some of the members of the watershed districts up in Detroit Lakes a month or so ago, and they identified two potential projects ahead that could be, designed and planned with that idea as a component of those flood damage reduction projects. And then we're also going to look at retrofitting one currently that exists in North Ottawa project to see if part of that could be used for the same idea. So we have three specific sites that we're going to take a look at.
Chair Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you have any idea of what the value is in terms of dollars or acres of wetland credits that could be established in those projects?
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chair, I don't right now, but the staff and the engineers for the watershed districts are looking at the feasibility, to how they could reconstruct or plan in those elements, and then we can, from that, derive a cost estimate.
Chair Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how far are we from maybe having something more concrete other than just having meetings?
Director.
Mr. Chair, I would say by this spring we should have some feasibility, or at least preliminary feasibility assessments of both the existing site at North Ottawa and the two sites. I can't remember which ones they were now, but there were two sites that are on the list for the Red Board's priority schedule that could be we could plan that in.
Thank you. It appears we've come to the end of our list. Thank you to the testifiers. And with that, we are adjourned.